This is Knowing Faith, a podcast of the Village Church. I'm Kyle Worley, and today I'm joined by my co-host Jen Wilkin and JT English, and we're going to be discussing the role of brothers and sisters in working together for theological formation in the life of seminaries, religious institutions, and in the life of the local church. We jumped in on this topic because a conversation was really initiated with an article that John Piper in Desiring God put out a few weeks ago. We love that ministry. We love John Piper. I think we land in some different practices than where the article landed, but we just felt like it was a good opportunity to not blow through that article because we really love that man and that ministry, but to just say, well, we land in some different places and talk about how we're seeing those things play out in the life of our own team and in the life of this local church and what we believe the Bible's vision is for male and female partnership when it comes to the cultural mandate, the Great Commission, and theological formation and partnership. So we hope you enjoy the discussion. All right, so JT, I just started West Wing again. How many times have you watched West Wing, JT? Be honest.
I've watched West Wing 5 times from beginning to end.
Okay, what's the name of your dog?
Bartlett.
What's the name of the president on West Wing?
President Bartlett. Okay. And just to be clear, my dog's name is spelled the same way as President Bartlett, with only one T at the end. Most people misspell my dog's name.
Okay, that's weird. okay, so for the listeners who maybe have not watched West Wing, it's a show about the White House, and we're not going to be talking about it on the podcast today, but JT...
Can we do a podcast on the West Wing?
Kyle, you're outnumbered on this one. I love the West Wing, too.
No, I love the West Wing, too. I'm starting in on number 3, my 3rd time through.
Okay, good.
Yeah, so I'm familiar with it. So JT, if you had to peg yourself, Jen, and then as characters on West Wing, who would you go
with? Well, I'm definitely President Bartlett.
Oh my gosh. I don't even know why I asked that question.
That's actually not true. If I could be any character on the West Wing, I would be Sam Seaborn.
Really?
Yeah, I can see that.
I really, really like Sam's character a lot. I kind of aspire to be like Sam a lot.
Okay.
This person will remain unnamed, but when I first met somebody that I really respect and admire, when they were just getting to know me, before they knew I watched the West Wing, they said to me, "You remind me of a guy in a character in a show called The West Wing, Sam Seaborn." Mm. And I was like,
"Did you hug him?
Yeah,
did
anything
you like
you
full
need
body
from
hug
me,
him? Yeah.
I serve at the pleasure of you for the rest of my life."
Did that guy's name rhyme with Pal Bowler?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay, yeah.
So you are definitely. Gosh, this is so hard. I mean, I know who you want to be, which color is it? Uh-huh. But I'll just give it to you because you do remind me of Toby.
Ah, thank you. Yeah.
Mm. I would have said that too.
My spirit animal.
Yeah. Do you remember the gift I gave you?
Oh, yeah.
Started working?
Tennis ball.
Yeah. Well, not a tennis ball.
Oh, a racquetball.
A little racquetball.
Yeah,
thing.
I remember.
I didn't get a gift, but that's cool.
That's okay. Well, yeah. That's
it's a gift just to work with you guys. Yeah, so it's.
There we go.
Yeah.
So who's Jen?
That's tough.
It is not tough.
No, it is.
Oh, you have a character that you immediately feel like
that's
me?
Yeah.
I mean, I think I have it too, but I kind of feel like I shouldn't say.
Mandy.
Oh.
You have to have watched the show.
My wife, every time she shows up, she goes, "She's the worst."
The worst.
She's the worst.
Yeah. You're definitely not Mandy.
I mean... I want to say CJ.
Totally.
I
want to
say CJ.
Okay, I felt like...
Why were you scared about that? She's fantastic.
No, she's great. I just... You know, she's great.
She's great. You're definitely CJ.
Well, at this point, if we haven't lost you, you may be thinking, what did I tune in for? This is a West Wing recap. It's not. There's another podcast for that out there. But today, we're actually going to be talking just about the way that brothers and sisters, that men and women in the life of the local church, but also just in the life of the world, collaborate together in God's kingdom. And the reason that we're bringing this up is because there was an article that came out. Now it's been a few weeks, maybe even almost a month ago, and a lot of people were talking about it. And the article came from a source that we really love and a person we really respect. It was John Piper in Desiring God. And it was an article about the role of women in seminary teaching. And when I know that as a team, when we first read the article, we thought, okay, well, we might land in a different place. And we had some different convictions, but there was a lot of fire around the topic when it first came out. And it's really something that's close to our hearts because it's something that we're trying to build here as a team, right? I mean, it's something that we've been aiming for and working together. And so we want to acknowledge that John Piper has been a huge formative influence on all three of us, that he's been a huge formative influence on the life of this church. And we also want to acknowledge that while we're speaking from a unique context and a unique situation, so is he. Bethlehem and their vision for seminary is deeply tied to their vision for the local church. Their seminary and their church share a lot of leadership overlap and has really been kind of tied at the hip. And so there is kind of a unique vantage point that they're speaking from. But we wanted to just kind of open up the conversation and talk about it from our perspective and the way that we've kind of been seeing this play out and the convictions that have been driving the goal that we've been aiming for. And so I'd love to just open up the conversation with this. I think a lot of times when we're talking about men and women, and specifically in complementarian circles, and we're card-carrying complementarians, right?
Is that a thing?
Well,
you don't have your card?
If it is, it's the lamest club in the world. but we are in the complementarian tribe. We love these people. We are these people. But as we think about it, it seems like the conversation starts often here. Okay, what can men do and what can women do? And so it starts from immediately difference and division. Is that really the best place to begin? Is that where Scripture begins?
Well, I wouldn't say that's where Scripture begins. I think that Genesis 2 is actually a huge affirmation of actually that we have more in common than divides us, which is not to diminish the truth that the things that make us not interchangeable matter a lot. But I think sometimes when it comes to complementarian thought, because we're not exactly sure what to do with the differences, we see them as things that should separate us into different spheres instead of as necessary components of just about any sphere in the life of the church. That the reason that the woman is not interchangeable with the man is because her presence is actually needed. That idea of it is not good for the man to be alone is probably speaking to a bigger issue than just that men should get married because they will otherwise be lonely. Hmm.
Yeah, some of the language that we've used in the past is that men and women are each other's necessary allies mm-hmm. in the mission of God that's going forth from Genesis chapter 1 and chapter 2, is that we would be involved in a complementarian mission together, kind of both participating in this cultural mandate and ultimately the Great Commission. And anytime we see a gender not participating in the cultural mandate of the Great Commission, we would want to say that mission suffers and that genders are suffering.
Right. And I think it's important to be really clear. Anybody who's familiar with the way that I talk about these things and even what I do on a week-to-week basis in terms of ministry, I place an enormous value on single-gender environments. Mm-hmm. What we are not arguing for here is that there ought to be no place in the church where there are just men gathered or just women gathered, but we do want to ask some questions with regard to leadership and with regard to authority in the local church and how the differences of men and women working together versus in separate environments actually are for the good and the flourishing of the local church.
And you just hit on something that I think is really important in this conversation, and I think this is where we'll end up spending some time, is that I feel like in complementarian circles, and I think it's reflected in this article, there is this equation, maybe it's a formula, that goes something like, well, the highest form of leadership in the life of a local church is eldership. Eldership, complementarians are agreed upon, is reserved for men. Mm-hmm. So if eldership is the highest level of leadership in the life of a local church, and only men should hold that office, then shouldn't it just be that all leadership in the life of a local church or in the life of religious institutions is male in nature? Because, listen, eldership's kind of the crown jewel, and only men can be elders. Do we feel like some of that formula is at work in leadership conversations in the life of a local church and in religious institutions that are complementarian?
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, we're in a church of an enormous size here at the Village, and so we've had to grapple with some of this in ways that a church that is maybe of 150 wouldn't necessarily. It may be possible that the elder pastor role in a smaller church is more comprehensive, but in our church, we're under no illusion that our elder pastor contributors are able to carry the entire load of leadership. And sure. So we've had to think about this in some lanes that perhaps other churches haven't.
I think related to that too, even if let's just say it seems like right now there's kind of this intramural conversation in within complementarianism, and this is really kind of I think putting our thumb on the issue, at least in, from my experience in the conversation, is that do we not have a vision though where we would say that that men are, or better said, qualified men are the only ones who can hold the office of elder, that elders is to be there to be the overseers, the those who are kind of guarding doctrine, teaching the mm-hmm. apostolic deposit and giving it to the church. We would still want to say that there is absolutely a necessary place for women to have formal channels of input into that room or into that elder body, because that's 50% of the congregation or more at mm-hmm. times.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think even more than just formal levels of input, certainly we believe that there are men and women who will not serve as elders in the life of a local church who should still be leading in the life
Absolutely.
Of a local church.
Yeah.
Because I feel like one of the things that happens is that when we equate kind of eldership as the highest level of authority, which it is in the life of a local church, and we say, well, that's really the place where you can most lead, it doesn't just undermine women leading in the life of a local church, it can undermine men leading in the life
that's
of
right.
a local church as well, mm-hmm. right?
Or it should. It often doesn't. You know, a
sure.
lot of times because we can fall into thinking that holy equates leadership and authority as masculine.
Mm-hmm.
Men are often de facto given leadership positions that women are not considered for just because they're men.
Yeah. Well, what are, I mean, and maybe we should pause here. What are some of the unique strengths that women bring to leadership that would be neglected if they weren't invited into that?
Well, you know, you can talk about them in generalities. Obviously, we're always sure. talking about individuals, not, you know, just categories. But I do think that when we root this in an understanding of biology, which
right.
is really where complementarians take this, and for good reason, when you understand that women don't outgrow vulnerability the way that men do, you know, a man typically grows to a form of physical strength that a woman just doesn't. And it means that as an embodied female, I'm going to walk through life with a different vantage point than an embodied male will. And in fact, if you look at all of our social structures and governing structures, they're in place and they accommodate typically men and male concerns because of this physical dominance issue that's been present since the Garden of Eden, right?
Yeah.
Which means that women may typically have eyes for the marginalized, the voiceless, those who are more vulnerable, with a little more immediacy than men will, just mm-hmm. simply because they can develop a forgetfulness around those things as they move into adulthood.
I agree. This is so crucial for me. And really, you have taught me so much about this in the last year and a half that I've been working closely with you. I just feel like it's a part of this picture that I have not seen clearly around the issue specifically of felt vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the church is seeing this play out and culture is seeing this play out right now with Me Too
yes,
and church
absolutely.
Too, right? Because that is a very specific concrete application of going, you know what? There might have been systems at play. There might have been structures at play that just were blinded from seeing some very obvious things.
Right.
That were perpetuated because there were no women leading.
Well, and you know, even the response of men to the Me Too movement has been, it's been bewilderment, right? It's been like,
right.
wait, this is what life is like for you? And then just disbelief because it is so foreign to their experience. And I always like to say, I mean, I have four brothers and a dad and a husband who I have great relationship with. I don't perceive men to be villains. Like my first
right.
thought about men is not that they're villains and they're out to keep the woman down. That's not been my experience. But even the good men in my life have had a hard time grappling with that this is the common shared experience of being a woman.
Yeah. And I think this is particularly relevant, getting back to maybe the article that stimulated the discussion, is that if there are no women seminary professors, which again, just to state where my cards are, I just don't think the Bible gives us that grounds. I think the Bible is very clear in what it prohibits, and this is not one of the things it prohibits. So there's that. But if you table that, I think a consequence of not having women speaking in seminary environments is that the next generation of elders, if that's all that a seminary is meant to be training for, which is fine, I don't think it is, but if it was all that a seminary was aiming to train for, I still think there would be a role for people who would never hold the office of elder, right?
Mm-hmm.
Both men and women, for that matter, who would never hold the office of elder, to teach future elders, hey, when you're in that position, you might need to look out for this because instinctively, you're probably not going to have your eyes open to it.
I think that's exactly right, especially as we think about, and I think what we want to do as we engage with this conversation, and particularly this article, is take it on its best merits. Like we would want Pastor John to recognize his argument here, and I think you've done a good job of talking about what Bethlehem College and Seminary does. Right. They're thinking specifically about training pastors. But even in that, let's just say that argument is true, it is inconceivable to me, and I think it's inconceivable to the biblical narrative that we would have a group of men who've been largely only formed by one gender, men only. And it is actually, if you think about these other movements that are happening right now, if they have not been shaped by another situated perspective, specifically that of women, they're going to be malnourished pastors, and they're going to therefore have malnourished congregations.
Absolutely.
I had a conversation with a woman several weeks ago who was earnestly concerned that she would do material harm to her 13-year-old son if she were to instruct him in the scriptures. And, you know, I had to reassure her, hey, hang on a second. Mm-hmm. You know, like, just by virtue of having more years than he does, you're always going to have wisdom that you can impart to him. And you will always have a formative role in the life of your child. That's why the fifth command talks about honoring both your father and your mother. And it's a command that's given to adult children, right? That there's always something to be learned from our biological parents. So I think if you draw that parallel out to the family of God, mm-hmm. it's not just an issue of brothers and sisters, but that's a very beautiful part of it. It's also an issue of fathers and mothers. And I think that often we're missing a space in our understanding for the role of church mother, which can leave us in danger in the local church of functioning as a single parent authoritarian family where there's a father, but then there's an absentee mother.
This has been a pivotal part of the conversation for me, thinking about the local church as a family in a very special sense. So the Bible is continually using this brother-sister language or this Philadelphia love that's supposed to kind of be embodied within the local congregation. But then even this single parent home, as you've just described it, that also seems to be foreign to the New Testament. As you think about a passage that's been helpful for me is Romans chapter 16. Paul is continually commending the women who are participating in the mission of God with them. So he commends Phoebe as a deacon of the church. It's likely that she's very involved in somehow the delivering of the letter to the church at Rome, or is at least involved in helping finance Paul's ministry. But then you also have in Romans chapter 16, verse 13, Paul says this. He says, "Greet Rufus, chosen in the Lord, also his mother, who has been a mother to me as well."
I love that
too, and I'm not trying to build up this entire complementarian picture from this passage. I think this is a much bigger picture that the Bible provides us. But Paul here is acknowledging a woman who's been very influential in him, and I think he could probably have a very hard time removing her influence on his life from how he would be ultimately an apostle.
Right, and we could probably list dozens of instances where this happens. I love in Acts 18, talking about partnership, which is where I want us to head right now, but he talks about Apollos. So Apollos is preaching the gospel boldly in Ephesus, right? And then what does it say? He began to speak boldly in the synagogue, but when Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they took him and they explained to him the way of God more accurately. I love that because it's this partnership of a man and a woman coming alongside Apollos and saying, hey, let me explain to you. Like, you're missing some of the things here. Like, I love the fact that this man and woman get to collaborate together in theologically correcting one of the loudest mouthpieces for the gospel in the early church. Mm-hmm. That's a really beautiful picture of seeing collaboration and partnership.
And if you think about any time you've received loving critique from someone, it takes a high level of trust in that relationship to even be able to receive it. And so if it takes a high level of trust for a man to receive loving critique from a man, think about the level of trust required for a man to receive loving critique from a woman, right? And yet, if we develop church structures which only allow for men and women to sort of inhabit separate rooms, then there's no space for deep trust to develop between a man and a woman so that a woman can give that input into the life of the church or into his leadership.
So we've been talking about this, I guess, kind of roundly, and we've moved a little bit, but what suffers if there's no partnership? We've mentioned a few specific examples, but is there anything else that suffers?
I mean, I feel like we could talk about this for a while, but I mean, I would want to point back to, again, just Genesis chapter 1 and 2. The Lord seems to think that the cultural mandate and the mission of image bearers and the image of Jesus Christ ultimately being what captivates and all of creation, that is what's going to suffer if we don't see men and women partnering together for the purpose of mission. That sounds like a really big deal, according to the vision of Genesis chapter 1 and chapter 2, is that there should not be many environments where we don't see men and women correspondingly partnering together for the sake of the kingdom.
If you look at the cultural mandate, the whole be fruitful and multiply, if the woman isn't added to the equation, there is no literal fruitfulness in that relationship. You have to have the woman for there to be fruitfulness in the cultural mandate. So you pull that forward to the New Testament counterpart to the cultural mandate, to the Great Commission. Be fruitful and multiply, right? Go and make image bearers. That's the paraphrase for the Great Commission, to go and make disciples. And so if we can acknowledge that in the first statement, there is no fruitfulness without the woman partnering with the man, then I think it follows that we would want to acknowledge that in the second statement, the Great Commission, fruitfulness and multiplication is not possible without male-female partnership.
Yes, that is very well said. So let's talk personally, because I could have spent the whole all 20 minutes of our time talking on this, just talking about the role of women informing me specifically. But I'd love to just open it up. What have been some of the specific examples that you have, how it's played out personally for the role of women in shaping and informing you?
Yeah, I'll give one maybe personal example, but then also maybe a few institutional ones that have been helpful for me. So, I mean, just part of my personal story was coming to know the Lord as a freshman in college, 2 weeks later meeting my wife, who had known the Lord for a lot longer. And from that day forward, my wife, Macy, has been by far the most instructive Christian in my life in terms of embodying the way of Jesus Christ in incredibly beautiful ways. I can't point to somebody who has been more formative in on my life and what it means to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. Now, of course, that isn't what we're talking about here in terms of seminary education, which I want to get to next. Right. But there has been a woman who's been a part of my life who has been incredibly valuable. I could think of women at Dallas Seminary who were valuable in my education. I think of Sandra Glahn and Sue Edwards. But I also think of many of my classmates who were so influential in those early years of being in Greek class or church history class, that were offering their perspectives in class that were absolutely invaluable. I think about there being environments in the classroom where male students aren't partnering next to female students and vice versa. What was lacking? And those students that were involved in those classes were so helpful because they're thinking about the text from a different perspective.
Yes.
Esther Meek has been somebody.
Oh my gosh.
Fleming Rutledge recently.
Yeah, Esther Meek.
Writing.
I mean, when I think about the way that I approach the knowledge of God, everything that I teach and the way that I go about researching, the way I go about studying has been affected by my time with Esther Meek, by just sitting and listening and reading her books. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's been, I cannot pull away the fingerprints that she's placed on my life. I think about, I mean, and this isn't to puff up Jen, but I think about my time with Jen, which has just been so formative on the pastor I'm aspiring to be, the student of Scripture that I'm trying to be in my own personal study. And so I love that we're not just getting to say like, oh yeah, we've had this experience, but I feel like it's something that we're going to experience right now.
I feel like we get to experience this here. I mean, it's part of our role. I'm continually, I feel like I have such a great amount of joy of getting to partner with you guys in doing this. It's been so formative in my early years of pastoral ministry.
Right, and I think it's been the feedback on the podcast.
Yeah, it's been fascinating. Ever since we started doing the podcast, the number of emails that I get from both men and women saying, I've never heard men and women sit down and talk this way to one another. And I think when we started doing this, we were like, this will be fun. Let's go do this. And I don't know how strategic we were about thinking about that being something that was communicated. But also, you know, people will say, oh, you sound like you're having such a good time. And we're doing what we do when we're not in the studio capturing a podcast. Like, that's what I love about it, is like, this is representative of the way that we interact on a daily basis with one another. And it's just really been one of the greatest joys of my adult ministry experience has been to get to interact with you guys on that level.
So, JT, I'd love, because I've heard you encourage, I think particularly of sometimes I've seen you speak to our sisters who are interns in the life of our church right now, and how you've addressed them and encouraged them as they consider what the Lord is calling them to do. And so if there is maybe a young woman who read that article or is listening to this podcast and they're saying, you know, I think the Lord is calling me, like the Lord is calling me to step into the life of the mind. I want to go and pursue seminary education because I want to write books, because I can't find any good books written by complementarian theologians on the cross mm-hmm. or on the resurrection. I want to step into that space. What would you tell them? How would you encourage them for leadership in the church or seminary or professorship or whatever?
I'm so glad we're trying to answer that question, because I think one of the unintentional effects of Pastor John's article is maybe a lack of a realization of some of the pain that would cause somebody who is interested in pursuing a life of the mind academically and theologically and in the life of an institution and a seminary. I don't think that was his intention, but sure. I do know for a fact that based on some of the notes that I got, emails I got, that was something that was deeply kind of startling and shaking for a lot of women in the life of the church pursuing that. And so my encouragement to you would be, if you're listening to this and you're somebody who feels called to that, and maybe doesn't feel called to that, that the Lord is calling to that, we need you. Full stop. This is something that is absolutely necessary, not only in institutions like seminaries and Bible colleges and other parachurch ministries, but in the life of the church. Your voice isn't just a nice component that is an add-on. It is an absolutely necessary ally for us thinking about theological education, both in the church and outside the church. And so please go forward. We know that your education might come at great cost, whether that be mm-hmm. financial cost. We know that it comes at great cost related to other family considerations and job considerations, but it is something that is so worthwhile and most importantly needed. So if you're listening to this and that's you, we want to be a part of this conversation that encourages you to press forward into the mission of God, of what he's calling you to do, because your mind matters. How you contribute theologically and vocally to the life of the church matters. So keep pushing forward.
Amen. I thought that was a really fruitful discussion, and I'm grateful. I'm grateful for your willingness to engage on the topic, and we're grateful that we had the opportunity.
Can I maybe even just add something there too?
Here we go.
Well, because here's something that I've learned.
I took the mic from you. You got to take it back.
Well, here's something I've learned in the midst of this conversation. Is it something I've been thinking a lot about the last year or two, is a recognition that it is a conversation and we need multiple kind of channels of input.
Yes.
And so we want to invite others to the conversation. Please. We realize that complementarity in terms of a theological vision is kind of uniform, but it is not uniform in terms of its practice.
Right.
And so that's something that we've tried to learn at the Village, is that we want to partner with men and women who might disagree with us slightly in terms of how this is practiced.
To sharpen us.
To sharpen us, because we need that. That happened in the midst of this conversation for me, and I think it happened for others. But we also want to make sure that we are committed to this vision of complementarity, because we do think it is what the Bible teaches.
Yep. It's been really encouraging that the conversation happened. I don't know that 5 or 10 years ago it would have. And so, I mean, that's a sign of health. I think that people are really thinking hard about these things. And, you know, we don't have to all agree on it. I do think that we all have to be able to visibly demonstrate the equal value of women mm-hmm. at the local church level. And that's going to require different things of us depending on where we fall on the scale of complementarity. Mm-hmm. But we're allowed to disagree on this.
I mean, this could be an environment for evangelicals, specifically those of us in kind of maybe conservative / maybe reformed circles that are committed to complementarianism, is we can actually value maybe something that's even more important: charity within theological dialogue, love for one another.
That's always a good practice.
In the midst of disagreement, which is hard for us on issues that are important, that are culturally sensitive, but this is a wonderful opportunity for us to do that with other brothers and sisters.
Right.
Yeah, I agree. And we're active learners. And so I think maybe just a fun way to kind of wrap this up is, I think sometimes people hear this and like, well, they've already read all the books and settled all the things. And then they just get in the room and kind of just dump that out. But that's not the case. We're actively learning, actively studying, kind of trying to stoke the fires, the life of the mind. And so I would love to just maybe end on kind of a different note of what are you reading right now? What are you enjoying? What are you learning? Jen?
Oh, don't look at me. I mean, I'm always reading stuff, you know, to prep for teaching, but that feels like a cop-out to say that here. And also my New Year's resolution was that I was going to commit to pleasure read again. Mm. So what I'm about to say may not sound like pleasure reading, but I'm trying to read Anna Karenina this year.
Oh, yeah.
Because my son has challenged me. I've never read any of the Russian authors, and so this will be my first. And I have an English degree, so I probably should have come across them somewhere, but I didn't. So I feel like it's a gap in my literature. Exposure.
I'm just imagining Jen Wilkin feet up at the beach with a 500-page Anna Karenina.
I'm a mountain
and
girl.
A pug.
Okay,
and
a mountain. Okay.
And a pug.
And a pug. And a pug, yeah. Tucked in with a pug, for sure.
When you say that that you feel like it's a cop-out to say something that you're not reading for teaching prep, I don't know what that means. Because I feel like all I'm reading recently feels like that. I'm reading two books. I'm reading commentary on 1 Corinthians. Not, of course, the whole thing front to back, but just doing some research on Gordon Fee's 1 Corinthians commentary, which is a really, really really fruitful book if that's something you're interested in. And then a book by David Benner called The Gift of Being Yourself is kind of outside of my normal maybe stream of reading. It's a wonderful book. He's kind of playing on Calvin's idea of there's two kinds of knowledge of God and knowledge of self, and how we often emphasize the knowledge of God, and appropriately so, but how we de-emphasize the knowledge of self. So what does it mean to be you? Is really what the book is exploring. Like, who are you? And it's kind of shaking, if I'm honest, in a way. It's like, okay, I've not thought about this in a while. Yeah,
that book will jack you up. Yeah. It will mess you up.
Can I borrow a pug?
Yeah. I loan them out.
A comfort pug. I'm reading Tish Harrison Warren's book, The Liturgy of the Ordinary, and I love it.
She is sharp.
I love the book. I really do. I feel like I preached recently, and I was like, hey, you... Like, I just had to take a moment and like, hey, unrelated to what I'm doing, I got to sneak this quote in because you have to read this book. It's a very good book. And I feel like she has such a – I know we've talked a lot about liturgy on this podcast, and we've talked a lot about story and narrative. We talk about that a lot in our environment. This book, more than any other book I've read, is really helpful of going, okay, this is what this means at 3:17 p.m. on Tuesday in the middle of a mess when your kids are screaming and you didn't get everything done you want to get done. It's a really good book, so I really enjoyed it. Listen, if there's anything that you heard us talk about on the podcast today that you're interested to hear more about, you can check tvcresources.net, and you can find a lot of different stuff there. If the complementarian conversation is something you want to investigate a little bit more, we've put up some resources on that topic even over the last year that we kind of have revised and looked at and prayed through and redrafted, and so we would really hope that you would check that out and benefit from some of those things. We have some incredible episodes coming up. We have an episode coming up on the doctrine of sin. We have an episode coming up with Tim Mackey from the Bible Project. We have an episode coming up with Jeremy Treat on the Crucified King. We have an episode coming up with Michael Kruger on the canon. And so some really exciting things coming up in future episodes. We hope you enjoy the discussion. Grace and peace.